The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There are two kinds of equanimity, words, Pali words, translated into English as equanimity. One is, the most common one is upekkha. And upekkha, upa, the prefix means towards, and the k part comes from the root meaning to see, to look towards. And it's sometimes explained as having a healthy overview of the situation or seeing it in the bigger perspective situation. And that brings equanimity. So the other is called, as a long word, but it's a very simple compound of simple words, tatra majja tata. And it basically means in the middle of it all. And I like to translate it as balance, to be balanced, and rather than equanimity. And so a certain kind of equanimity comes from being balanced. So, for example, if you have just the right amount of sleep, not too much and too little, then you'll kind of go through your life in a more balanced or healthy way. If you have too little sleep, you're on the edge and, you know, reactive. If you have too much sleep, you're just so groggy, you know, you don't hardly notice anything. And so, you know, you're balanced in terms of your sleep or food. You have a balanced, you don't eat too much, you don't eat too little. Exercise, you don't have too much, you don't have too little. You know, like on retreat, the balance of how much exercise you need changes than what it is maybe in daily life. So finding the balance, and that balance then supports you staying more centered, more equanimous, more kind of on top of things in a nice way. In meditation itself, the tradition points to a number of mental factors that are very helpful to hold in balance. So, for example, concentration and energy should be balanced. If you have too much concentration, not enough energy, people tend to fall asleep. If you have too much energy and not enough concentration, you tend to get restless and agitated. Those two qualities need to be in balance. The other two qualities that are often mentioned is faith and wisdom. If you have too much faith, it can be blind faith, it could lead to all kinds of problems. But if you have faith together with wisdom, then you have the wisdom or you have the capacity to discern, to look more carefully, to question, to look at the nuances of how things actually are rather than applying some blind faith to it. But if you have too much discernment, too much process of thinking and analyzing what's going on, then it also might kind of remove you from the experience and leave you a little more kind of aloof or intellectualizing about things rather than really kind of a heartfelt connection to what's going on. And so they say there should be a balance between faith and discernment, faith and wisdom as well. I think of balance as being kind of like a ballast. That if you have there's a variety of things that provide a strong sense of ballast. The ballast is a boat has a ballast, it doesn't tip over very easily. A boat without ballast will tip over in its smallest wind. So what gives us ballast? A kind of strength that keeps us from tipping over too easily. And so, for example, mindfulness of the body, being really connected to your body is very, very helpful for this process. The more connected you, strongly connected to the body, I think the more ballast you have, the less you're likely to let the mind be an overdrive or the mind kind of take over automatically. You notice what goes on more carefully. Developing strength of concentration, for example, or calm, creates a certain kind of ballast. Probably most of you have had the experience of how, you know, getting calm in meditation lends itself to being calmer through the next period of time, and so you find yourself much more patient and much more at ease with things that otherwise would be trying for you, and you don't snap at your friends so easily or something. And so, you know, the calm is kind of like the ballast that keeps you from, you know, reacting quickly. Loving kindness, you know, practice can also create calm, but also create kind of some strength or some ballast and sense of friendliness or kindness, which is there, that kind of in the atmosphere, in the mood, or something that also provides kind of a ballast of balance. So, you know, so if you find yourself, if you know you're going into a situation that can be very challenging for you, and you want to prepare for it, so you don't doesn't do you in, you consider, you know, what are things that help support me both being calm, insightful here, but also what keeps me equanimous in this situation. And so some people will meditate before they do. Some people will, you know, do a variety of things to kind of create that ballast. So they go into the situation with some stronger ability not to get caught up. And the ballast is primarily made from exercising something. You can't just say, you know, I'm going to have ballast. But you have to do something to change the conditions. So you have to, you know, maybe meditate regularly or get enough sleep or, you know, get enough food if you're not eating enough or, you know, something that kind of creates that kind of balance. And not just rely on your own powers of mindfulness as if that's going to do it, but maybe you need to bring in some other quality to help you in that situation. The other kind of equanimity is this having an overview or having a clear kind of perspective of what's happening. And that can come from many different things. It can come from insight, seeing clearly what's there. But it could also, you know, seeing clearly the nature of clinging. And see that clinging hurts. And so you can say, oh, you know, now I see why it's so difficult. I'm clinging here. And so I think I'll let go of the clinging. And then you find yourself more equanimous. It could also be that you have this kind of broader perspective of the situation. It keeps coming to mind today is a classic, common scenario when some people, when they're dying, slow and sometimes difficult deaths, they at some point near the end of the process, they'll get really angry with the people they're closest to, and sometimes do really say really mean things to, like, you know, a husband of 40 years or, you know, or a mother, or the mother says to the daughter something terrible. And it's completely out of character of the relationship in the past. And now, if no one's ever encountered this phenomenon before, I think this is the first time a dying person's ever snapped at someone, they take it personally and think, oh, this is terrible. But if you find out this is kind of an impersonal process, something goes on in the inner mechanisms of the brain or something, that that as people are dying, some different things come out in different ways, and it's not to be meant to be taken personally. It's kind of impersonal, not really meant about you, and so you say, oh, now I understand. So I've been warned. And there it is. She's doing it, and then you're less likely to take it personally. It's not all about me anymore. Just, well, I feel sorry for the person, and I'll try to not snap back or something. Now, one of the ways of having overview, I think, you know, some kind of clear perspective, is to have a really clear understanding about what's an effective response to different situations. What's the efficient or useful way of responding or taking care of different situations? So not just being mindful of the situation, but, you know, if you have to act in the world to do something, what is the efficient, useful way to do that? So, for example, if I have to go if I have to go to traffic court because, you know, I was speeding, you know, I could get really nervous, anxious, loss of sleep, worried about what's going to happen to me, this big authoritative figure sitting up high on a podium looking down at me, and fret a lot. But all that fretting and being nervous and all that, you know, second-guessing what I need to do probably is not so useful. Probably doesn't help me figure out what's the best response, how to kind of stand there and say the truth. So what I'm trying to point to is the idea that it wasn't very efficient or useful to spend all this time being nervous. If I had been really confident in the usefulness of just showing up and being honest and standing there and responding as necessary, if I had confidence in my ability to do that, then I would no longer have confidence in the value of being nervous. And I think that, you know, at least from the outside perspective, a lot of people have a lot of confidence in their nervousness, in their fear, or a lot of confidence in their anger, or their hostility, or their doubt. Because, I mean, why else do we do it so much? We must believe that it somehow is going to help, right? But if we really see that this doesn't really help, that might not help. Seeing that, might not make a big difference. But if you really know, if you really have confidence that you can respond without being nervous, without being attached, without contracting, without clinging, then you might be willing to let go of all the unskillful ways of fretting and being anxious or being angry around the whole situation. Because when we suggest people, be equanimous. Some people will protest and say, well then, how do I take care of myself? Or tell, let go. Just let go, right? Please. Well, let go is fine for you to say, but you don't realize that I have this difficult thing in my life, and I have to cling, I have to hold on, otherwise, you know, who's going to take care of me? Or if I don't cling and shut down, then, you know, how am I going to keep, you know, all those homeless people from squatting in my house? there's big dangers out there if I don't, you know, cling to something. But if we have confidence in our ability to say, someone knocks on our door and says, I'm homeless, can I stay with you? And you say, no. And you have confidence in saying no. And no, you can kind of stay there and hold your ground. You feel some. Then you don't have to fret and worry, or you don't have to hold on to being closed and not looking and pretending they're not there or something. You know you have, I can say no. It's like I was traveling in a foreign country where there was all these people begging. It was a real nuisance. I tried all kinds of ways of ignoring them or denying them. But I found the most effective way was to turn around my tracks, look at them in the face and say, stop it. maybe they weren't used to that kind of response. I remember in one country it was... there was all this kind of. So it was very difficult I guess there was kind of the rickshaw drivers, with these little the little taxi drivers, the bicycle rickshaw kind of things, because the negotiating the price was so difficult, and then there was all this back and forth and debating and who was taking advantage of who, and it was just it's just kind of a headache, the whole thing. What I learned was you don't ask the price. You say you want to go, but you know what the going rate is. And what I learned was you get on the taxi, you get in the rickshaw, you go where you're going to go, you jump off, and you hand them the going rate, and you walk away. And once I'd figured that out, the whole thing was quite easy. And I had confidence that was okay. Even though, they would yell at me as I was walking down the street. I knew it was a fair, it was quite a fair price. It wasn't like I was taking advantage of them, but, sometimes their price depends on your nationality. The price of the taxi drive depends on the nationality of the rider, right? So the whole thing is kind of like, kind of interesting. So I'm not doing such a good job here, but the idea is pointing out that to be confident in something, not something, but to be confident in our capacity to take care of ourselves appropriately without having to cling is a phenomenally important foundation for equanimity. And so the question is, what is it? how is it that a person learns to have confidence, enough confidence, in their own ability to respond so that they don't have to cling, don't have to get nervous, don't have to get angry, don't have to feel helpless? What does it take to be able to stand on your own two feet and be relaxed, trusting that understanding, trusting that what you're going to say next, what you're going to do next, the appropriate thing will come forth in such a way that you're safe, that you're taken care of? What does that take? So that's a topic I thought might be helpful to explore a little bit in terms of a realistic sense of how to find equanimity, to have that confidence in oneself and certain ability to respond. And so what is a good way to explore this? Is a whole group together, people sharing, or should we divide up into three or four very large groups and just go around the circle, people share, everyone has a chance to talk and share something, or in pairs, or in groups of three? Do you have, probably it's not fair to ask you, but...
Three or four large groups?
Small. Groups of three? Too tired to talk. So if you're big, so the whole big group would then you can fall asleep. And yeah, so what I think then, I don't know the right answer, but I have confidence. I have no shortage of confidence here. But yes, what? Yeah, that's not what I was thinking. So where it's going for me in my mind as I take all this in is I think some smaller groups would be good. And so I think that what I'd like to ask is that you form groups of five people, and that everyone speak. You go around the circle, and that the way of going around the circle is that each person doesn't talk for a long time, but offers something, some perspective, some idea, some practice, some question, something around what I just brought up about how can we have confidence in our own ability to take care of ourselves appropriately so that we don't have to cling, we don't have to react, we don't have to get nervous or angry or fearful. You know, how do we find that confidence to stand on our own two feet and offer something? And then once you go around, all five of you, do it again. And do like a spiral and keep doing it, as if each time you do it, you're contributing to the group mind, to the group conversation. And you're bouncing off each other, you learn from each other, what you each say to each other kind of triggers something else in your mind. And just see where the group goes. You just kind of keep kind of milking this topic round and round and round your circle. Does that make sense? And the important thing here is that one of the next most important things you need to be able to do, hopefully have confidence in it. Historically, I've learned not to have much confidence in your ability to do this, is your ability to count to five. So if maybe at least one of your group knows how to count to five. So if you can find groups of five, and if there's extra people, just stay standing and come to the front, and I'll help you find a place to go. So, maybe some of you would like to share a little bit what that was like, especially what you might have learned. Not so much what you taught. But what did you learn in that process? What was interesting for you?
And
It is always interesting how, on moving around like that, it keeps building and changing, and one thing reminds you of something else, or you hear it in a different way. But when somebody had said, just remembering that it's just temporary, that everything's impermanent, so no matter how, whatever you're being triggered by or you get caught, just if you can remember the impermanence of it, that is hugely helpful, that no matter how triggered you are, it's going to be gone in a minute. Yeah, it's going to change.
Great, thank you.
So I think bringing yourself back into the direct moment and realizing, regardless of what has happened, that you're actually here and okay in the moment, and using that as a practice to recognize the inherent right to be here, and that for that to create the confidence and, you know, to the confidence.
Right, that's a great point, and especially since most of our problems are imaginary. So to really be here and realize that here is safe, here we're grounded, can make a big difference. Right? Kate, give me the mic.
The fact of the Sangha itself gives me confidence that this many people chose to spend all day on Friday, and so many people come on, you know, weekly here, because they found it rewarding enough, not easy and not always leading to happiness or equanimity, but rewarding enough over time to continue to do it. And then, of course, others reminded me, yeah, that's been going on for 2,500 years, there must be something to it. But, so I guess it's really, that is perhaps a form of taking refuge in the Sangha, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
Beautiful.
And that is an expression of confidence.
Yeah, and that brings equanimity or greater willingness to be at ease and find your way, because you're on a good path, you're in a good, yeah. You have a good teaching, good practice to do together with others. Beautiful. Thank you. I'm beginning to feel this urge to call on people.
I think it's really crucial that you have a willingness to take risk. Because you can't experience something that you don't know unless you abandon what you know and step into what you don't know. So I think that that's a fundamental.
So, but how can you be willing to take risks in such a way that you're equanimous in doing it? Or stay balanced, or stay grounded, or stay...
You have to have conviction to release what you know and abandon anticipation, and that is courage. It's just something you choose.
Uh-huh. So courage is an important factor that supports equanimity in some situations.
I've learned something useful from the tides. I like to kayak, so does my wife. And usually we can only do that at high tide. So you have to sort of be there when the tide is high. And there's nothing I can do to change when high tide is high. It does not accommodate my schedule. So it became obvious how silly it was to be upset about the tide being high or low. The tide was just going to be the tide. And I would have to accommodate it. And that was sort of a step towards prying me away from my own sense that I had to control things. And it was just so obvious that the tides would do what they were going to do.
So the odd way, it's possible maybe to have more confidence in one's own capacity to respond to situations if we give up trying to control it. So you can have confidence that the tide will do what it does. You have confidence that you can, you know, accommodate yourself to the tide.
We all agreed in our group that practice putting yourself out there to do things that you don't know how to do, and being eventually learning how to do it, and then that gives you the confidence that in any similar situation you can also do it, and then that also generalizes to other kinds of situations. Mm-hmm. So practice makes perfect kind of thing.
So they have confidence that you know, you don't necessarily know how to do it unless you put yourself in a situation and learn, that you have the ability to learn. And one of the great ways of having some confidence like that is knowing that you'll learn from your mistakes.
Not to see failure as failure, but just a way of learning something.
Yeah.
The two previous speakers, I think, have laid a foundation for my volunteering, and also the threat that you might call on someone prompted me to volunteer. But someone down there said, taking refuge in the Sangha, and someone said, taking risks and courage, set the stage for my willingness to volunteer. And what I'm going to say might sound strange to you, but I'll preface it by giving you a brief background. Mind you, I grew up in an Asian family, and I was surrounded by Asians, and the whites are the people that when I stepped outside of the home, there were white people and there were no Asians, and that was my experience for about 25 years. Well, more or less, until I came to San Francisco, then I discovered there are so many Asians. So sitting in my group, and as we were going around, and we had one question, and I was struck by, and I was looking at my my peers, my group, very carefully, and they were non-Asians. But the things that they said were that would just somehow come out of the mouth of my father, my brother, my friends who are Asian. So it made me think that the wish to and ways to take care of oneself is universal and human, and that's. And I was thinking, oh, she thinks like that too.
Yeah.
Oh, he does too, and they're all white.
Thank you. That's great. I think that to have confidence, there's what your statement triggers a related thought, and that is that to have confidence in that part of our common humanity, I think is very helpful. That if we can actually meet and see each other in a heartful way, that a lot of beautiful things can be found out, can be discovered, can unravel, can unfold, and it's not always easy to have that confidence.
But I've got the microphone.
I didn't see. Go ahead.
I've always wanted to sing Tiny Bubbles every time I have this microphone in my but I think I'll wait for another event. No, I think that having confidence in honest communications without fear, that's just so big for me. And I've been really struggling a long time with that. But if I could just trust that, you know, with good intentions, with that honest communication is really, you know, is most beneficial.
Great, I love that, and it certainly helped me a lot in my life. When I know that, especially if I know that's reciprocated, that I don't have to be so careful as, you know, to always get it right. If I know that the person I'm with is willing to hang in there, we can have a process of honest communication of what happened, and then we can find our way. And that puts me much more at ease. Lori.
Going back to the couple of comments just before, in our group, it seemed like the practice of metta and the whole idea of the commonality of experience or the interconnectedness of others really helps to support that feeling of being able to step out of that comfort zone, or to be able to take care of ourselves in the not only seeing the commonality, but also in the heartfelt response of taking care of ourselves.
And there's a wonderful interplay between our commonality and our differences. And I would like to believe that if we can really see the deep, heartfelt commonality we all share, then at the same time, it's going to be a lot easier to appreciate and value each, all the differences as well. And they work together like two hands holding or something. Okay. So, I want to cover, we have 20 minutes left. I'd like to cover one more area of equanimity. It's has to do with the equanimity that's a Brahma-vihara. It's a divine abiding. There's many different kinds of equanimity. Buddhism has long lists of different kinds of equanimity. And one of the kinds is called the divine or the boundless abiding of equanimity. I like to define it as a form of love. And it's related to all the forms of it's related to the other kind of equanimity of the seven factors of awakening, because it's supportive of it. And it's a kind of the reciprocal of what we just talked about now. And that is the equanimity that comes from knowing that we are not responsible for other people's choices. And so just if that's really true, that we're not responsible for their choices, then how can we hold them in love with caring hearts at the same time? Because generally the notion of you're not responsible for other people's choices, it lends itself to the idea of indifference or separation or just aloofness, kind of like, you know, it's your problem. But if it's true, which it is, then we have to start there. And starting there, then what's if that's true, what's the loving thing to do then? How to stay connected in a way then? And I think that to understand how we're not responsible for other people's choices can be a great support to be equanimous in relationship to them. If we feel like we're responsible, it's up to me that person's happy. It's up to me that person whatever. Then I know that I can get anxious, I can get upset, I can get all kinds of, you know, I get tied myself in knots. And it's not helpful. If I realize the other person's responsible for his or her own choices, I can still be quite considerate about how can I be helpful, how can I be supportive, how can I be completely connected and, you know, offer what I can. But, and maybe what I offer is very significant, but I'm not hooked in. I'm not, my sense of ease or well-being or happiness is not dependent on me being in charge, being in control, being responsible. And in some situations this is obvious, it's pretty easy. In some situations very, very hard, especially when it's like a close relative, for example, or someone you're very close to. Sometimes it's very hard with a partner, because sometimes with partners there's a strong identification. Like, if you know, sometimes it's too much. Like they do something and it's like, you know, anybody else does that, it's fine, but but that person does it. It's like maybe because it, you know, mirrors, it reflects on you. You think you identify with that person. It's like you're doing it and they're doing it for you. And how could they? But how to step back and have a certain kind of caring for other people and not take responsibility. So why don't you get in a meditative position, close your eyes. And do whatever way you know to kind of get yourself settled. Relax. Perhaps letting go of thoughts, concerns. Do what you can to get yourself settled into your body, connected, in touch with yourself. And then I'm going to say some statements. And listen to them, take them in as if you're saying it yourself. And see what happens to you as you say these statements. Maybe you actually say them silently to yourself after hearing them. See how it affects you. Some of the statements have the word you in it. And when the you is there, think of some person, perhaps, that you know of, that you're directing this towards. So, to begin these statements, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your choices, not so much on my wishes for you. Whether I understand it or not, things are unfolding according to a lawful nature. All beings meet their joys and sorrows according to a lawful nature. May I accept things as they are. No matter how I might wish things to be otherwise, things are as they are. So to repeat some of them. You are the owner of your own karma. Your happiness and unhappiness depend on your choices, not my wishes for you. No matter how I might wish things to be otherwise, things are as they are. So the equanimity, which is a form of love, is one of the, I think, more challenging aspects of Buddhist practice for many people. It can fly in the face of what we usually believe, how we usually operate, fly in the face of what our concept is of caring and love for other people. But it, I found it very helpful to understand this aspect of not taking responsibility for other people. And for me, taking responsibility has been is like one of my Achilles heels. So, you know, this is something I've grappled with. But to, I think it's also a very generous thing to grant people the freedom of their own choices. Or in kind of early American vocabulary, to grant them the freedom of choice or freedom of conscience. So what it does is that you might feel bad about someone, you might feel sad about what people are doing. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're happy, equanimously happy that they're destroying their life. You might feel sad, but in a sadness there's a kind of equanimity where we're not getting anxious or tight or upset or kind of wound up around, I have to do something, it's all about me. So some part of you can stay balanced, can stay more equal, even keeled. And it just also turns out that if you can stay even keeled, that and generally we can actually help much better anyway. Sometimes we don't help as well if we're kind of right in there. So this is another condition that supports equanimity, is to have confidence or to have a real strong conviction or understanding of what our our responsibility is in relationship to other people. Because we can often lose our equanimity, our balance, get agitated by being pulled into that world. It's up to me. A corollary would be not taking responsibility for someone else, but insisting they're responsible for me. And you know, it's up to them to fix me, to help me, to save me, to do something. My happiness depends on them doing the right thing, and that's another way of losing equanimity, getting all wound up. And so equanimity is a hugely profound topic. We've scratched the surface today. We will, in about a year's time, come back to it, because next year, the Dharma practice days will be on the paramis, the perfections. And the last perfection is the perfection of equanimity. So here again, we see that equanimity is always at the end of these lists, because it's really builds and depends on the others. To expect to have deep equanimity just because it's a good idea, would be nice. But it's considered to be something that you really cultivate yourself for, and cultivation, development of yourself leads to a place where you can have a deep, abiding sense of equanimity. And with the paramis, there's a whole 9 other steps that support the arising of equanimity. So we'll visit it again next year. Those of you who didn't get it today. And we'll kind of do it gradually next year, build towards it. But we do have one more of these Dharma practice days on the 7 factors of awakening, which is in 2 weeks, so it's faster than usual. And Diana has made another one of her lovely handouts of reflections and practices for this. And in the back there's some quotes from the Buddha on equanimity. And because it's only 2 weeks, she truncated it in little bits. I think it's every 4 days they in a new reflection rather than every 7 days. And so you can, take one of these. And in the Dhammapada it says, as a solid mass of rock, is not stirred by the wind. So a sage is not moved by praise or blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. So may you be nourished by equanimity. May it help you thrive in your life and bring much happiness and joy for you. And thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate it a lot, spending the time with you. I hope this has been nice.